This is Community Radio, and you're listening to Liberación, the nexus of local and global politics, art, and struggle. Liberación provides audiences with perspectives rarely heard on corporate-sponsored media stations. Our guests include educators, grassroots activists, artists, workers, and independent analysts who engage both local and global struggles, embracing a vision of freedom, solidarity, and social change.
That's the sound of the police. 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 That's the sound of the police.
This is WFT 90.1 FM Community Radio.
That's the sound of the beast.
This is Antonia Dardera, and I will be your host for this segment of Liberación. Today, we will examine further developments in the shooting death of Kiwan Carrington on October 9, 2009, by a Champaign police officer. Important issues in this case revolve around questionable conduct by Champaign police, including Chief R.T. Finney, who was at the scene. Also of concern is the validity of State Attorney Julia Reed's controversial ruling of Kiwan Carrington's death as an accident, despite evidence that sheds doubt on her conclusions. Also important for listeners to keep in mind are the criminal charges being brought against Jayshon Manning Carter, Kiwan's friend, who was with him at the time of the shooting and is the only person facing criminal prosecution. The program will focus on two extensive interviews. The first, conducted by members of CU Citizens for Peace and Justice, is with Deborah Thomas, the Champaign resident at whose home Kiwan had been staying and where he was shot to death. The second interview is with Carrie Pimblot, a graduate student in history at the University of Illinois and a member of the Graduate Employee Organization Solidarity Committee, who is also working with the CU Citizens for Peace and Justice to research the facts surrounding Kiwan Carrington's tragic death. Carrie is interviewed by local community journalist Brian Doliner about the current status of the case and surrounding questions which still remain unanswered. So we begin this segment with Deborah Thomas's efforts to explain what she remembers about that fateful day.
And I started getting all these phone calls, then my sister called, my stepsister, Mary. She was like, you have got to get to your house real fast. There's a whole bunch of police out there. They got their guns out and everything. Something's going on. I'm like, what? Let me hang up. Then my phone blows up again. And then I said, let me check all these messages. So I checked one. One was from the dispatcher, something from the Champaign police. She gave me her name. Can't remember right now. It's on my phone. And she said, you need to get to your house real fast. Someone's been shot. So I called that number right back. And I'm like, this is Deborah Thomas, you know. And she was like, well, yeah, you need to, someone was shot trying to break into your house. I'm like, what? Yeah, you need to get there real fast. I'm like, okay. You know, but then I had to sit there and breathe about 30 million times, you know, because I'm thinking, Lord, the kids. That was the first thing I thought about. It had to be one of those kids. That's the first thing I thought about. So I finally came. Couldn't get nowhere from McKinley. You couldn't even get nowhere near here. So that's why I said I called. But I had to park way down the street anyway and walk up here. And I walked up here.
And you have no idea. They didn't tell you. What was it?
They didn't tell me nothing. I ran straight up here because you can see me on the news. Like what's going on? Because I asked the first girl that lives in the front, what's going on in my house? And I don't know. So I walk around. I try to head this way. Because actually, as I was walking down the street, is when I seen the ambulance going down the street. So that freaked me out even more.
So where did you meet the first police officer?
Right there. Actually, at the neighbor's part of the driveway. Because they had this. I couldn't even get nowhere near my home. And that's what even more I was fussing about. I'm like, what's going on? What's happening? Who got shot at my house? Man, we don't know right now. We don't know anything right now. We don't know nothing. That's all I was getting. We don't know nothing, you know. I'm like, well, what's going on? Someone was trying to break in your house. I'm like, well, who got shot? And then I see my dad. He was walking down the street. I'm like, was it one of those kids? Was it one of those kids? They're like, man, we can't tell you anything. That was Schweihart. He the one that pulled me on down the street, because that's way where his truck was parked at, way down the street. And as we were walking down, that's when I met my dad. He was like, what's going on? I was like, Daddy, I don't know. They said I shot somebody trying to go into my house and all that. My dad said the same thing. Was one of those kids? And Schweihart, out of his mouth, said, we can assure you guys it wasn't a kid. So my dad turned around and went on and got back in his car, which he had to park way somewhere, he said he parked at. He's like, as long as it wasn't none of them kids, I'm all right. So I got in the truck. I'm like, what happened? What happened? This is me and Schweihart in the truck. I'm like, you guys sure it ain't one of them kids? I said, the only thing I can think of who could be here today is you know, coming to try to, is one of those kids. I kept telling him that, one of those kids. He said, what do you mean? What's your son's name? I said, my son's name is Isaiah Thomas. He's like, what do you mean by one of those kids? I said, those boys, all his friends, everybody to be with him. So he bagged up. We bagged up and we parked right in front of the Brown House across the street. Some other cop came over. I couldn't see who it was because, you know, I'm in the front seat and he got out. And he was like, well, what's all your kids' name? What's the kid's name? I named my kids, which is Debrion, Jordan, Ebony, Isaiah. I said, but I'm talking about those other kids, those boys, you know, the kids, you know, to be around them all the time. He said, what's your son's name? I said, Isaiah Thomas. I said, Timmy, Kiwan, Coriel, and T-Man. Them the names I think I named. Those are all the names I named, and we were always around my son. Then I knew it was homecoming. Everybody skips at homecoming. You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, it had to be one of those kids. And I swore up and out. And I mean, to not even lie about my story, they even brought Officer Thomas. They called Officer Thomas from Central to check, to make sure. At first they said, your son's not at school. So I panicked again. Then I thought about it. I said, wait a minute. He was in school suspension. Check 107. 107. And that's where he was. So we knew it wasn't Isaiah. But I'm at, was it one of those kids? Mr. Thomas even met me at the police station.
Did he say anything to you there?
He came to meet me up there, actually, to tell me that Isaiah was at school in 107. So I was panicked because I knew it was a kid. And then actually, before we even got to the police station, they lied. They told me, this is straight out of Schweinhardt's mouth from whoever cop he was talking to on the side of the truck. They said, ma'am, you can calm down. It's not no kids. It was two grown men. Ma'am, that's all we can tell you. And then they took me on down to the police station. Like, I'm like, oh my God, I want to know who this is. This is all I want to know is what's going on. And then, two, I was actually going in my mind, why I got to go to the police station? Well, why am I the one being questioned? All I want to know is who got shot at my house.
Running deep as the ocean, many a call, but so few were chosen. As I go through the motions, a medication up in my doses, banging earth, winning fire, devotion as I admire the focus. Taking the city with a grain of salt, with it tasting foul, chase it down with the latest mark. Liquor, roll it, hit it, now you did it. Hope you got some smarts, which you hope you got some heart. It ain't stopping when it start, nigga. Feel something bigger, got a hold on me. I ain't tripping out of Bobby Brown, lipping with my nose running. Basically, I had two options. I just chose one and then got ghost like my picture was on the most wanted. Coast to coast, from LA to Chicago. Now I'm faced with the weight of survival, plus the taste from the way I've been lied to while I'm preaching, man, spitting this gospel. I could win if I tried to.
Listening to Liberacion on WFT 90.1 FM Champaign Community Radio. Deborah Thomas speaks about her experience at the Champaign Police Station.
When I got in there, there was already some people in there, some police.
What kind of police?
They were the Rantoul police.
How many police officers were there?
I want to say three.
Talk about some of the questions that they asked you.
First question I can actually remember, do you know why anyone would want to break into your home? I'm like, no, because I don't have anything. I'm poor.
Did they tell you that someone had broken into your home?
No. Nope. They said that someone got shot trying to break into my house. Then, that's when they started asking me about Kiwan. So I answered everything I knew about Kiwan. I know his mother, Rita, she was a friend of mine. We lived like four houses down on Champaign Street. Been knowing about 3.5 years, you know. I knew that she passed. And then, how do you know Kiwan? I'm like, he's my son's buddy. He's my son's friend. And my kids showed up. I walked on out. I sat in the waiting room for a minute. And they said, oh, we have to call you back in because we didn't get yours on audio.
Did you sign anything?
Yeah.
What'd you sign?
I signed them consent to coming to my home.
What did you think you were signing?
They told me to sign. They asked me to sign a piece of paper to make sure to check that no one else was inside my house.
Did you read the piece of paper?
Yeah, I've read enough of it to where it was saying what they were telling me, that just consent to give them to search my home. that not just pull everything out. They were just supposed to look. They told me personally they were coming to my house to make sure nobody else was in there.
Did they tell you that they were going to break down your door?
No.
Did they ask you for keys?
No. But see, they gave me the impression that the home was already broken into.
In the first interview, did they talk about your windows, your doors?
Yeah.
Yeah. Those same, you remember when they were asking about?
Yeah. I told them they all got little lock things on them. I always flick them all up, so even if somebody tried to open them, it's only going to stop, you know, a certain way. And then I remember them coming out, do you want to see him before we ship him off? And then I remember asking my son, who is that? He said, that's Jay Sean, mama. I'm like, that's what they mean by Deshaun. They saying the wrong name.
How did you know that Deshaun was in the building?
I didn't know until I seen my son talking to him. I was like, who is that? That's Jay Sean, mama. Who is Jay Sean? I'm like, that must be the Deshaun they talking about. Okay. So he was there.
When you came out after the second interview, who was in the waiting room then?
My son was out on the couch out there crying. And then that's when a cop comes rushing towards me and they sit me down to tell me that it was Kiwan. And see, that's when I got even mad. I already knew it was Kiwan when I seen my son crying. I said, Kiwan, and he said, yeah. I asked him, how you know? He said, because I just seen his auntie downstairs. And they down there fussing. And then that's when a cop comes shooting over to me. I don't know who it was. She's talking about, I'm sorry, but it was Kiwan that got killed at your home. And I'm like, what? And so I'm like really all through then, and I ain't been right since.
Must rise to bear this cross alone, and all the heathens go free. Just say
jump,
no.
Jump. Just say no,
just say
jump,
no,
just say no.
Must rise to live in misery and even in luxury. Just say no,
just say no,
just say no,
just say no.
It's coming to tear down the walls of depression, drive away transgression, clean up corruption, rule equality. Must righteous live in pain and always put to shame. Just say
jump,
no.
Jump, just say no.
Just say
jump,
no.
Jump, just say no.
Must they be found guilty and always get the blame? Just say
jump,
no.
Jump, just say no.
Father,
jump,
say no.
Jump, just say no.
He's gonna tear down the walls of depression. Drive away transgression, clean up the corruption, set the captives free. He will not give an eye more than I can bear. Just say
jump,
no.
Jump, just say no.
Just jump, say no.
Jump, just say no.
He will not make Lucifer get your soul to smear. Just say
jump,
no.
Jump.
My father say
jump,
no.
Jump, just say no.
He man got teared on the walls of Babylon. Clean up the corruption. Drive away transgression. Rule equality. Of a Babylon, eliminate Satan, clean up corruption, rule equality. So I will not bear this cross alone, and all the world go free. Just
You're listening to Liberacion on WFT 90.1 FM Champaign Community Radio.
The campaign to end the death penalty national speaking tour, Lynch Then, Lynch Now, will stop here in town on Wednesday, February 24th at 7 p.m. The event will be held at the University of Illinois' Gregory Hall, room 307. The address is 810 South Wright Street, on the southwest corner of the Quad. Champaign-Urbana has found itself at the center of a fight to tackle racism in the criminal justice system in the wake of the murder of Kewan Carrington, an unarmed 15-year-old African-American youth, at the hands of Champaign police. This year's tour looks at the historic link between the death penalty and lynching in the United States. Hear from those who have been freed from death row, activists and scholars on the role of racism in our criminal justice system, and why the death penalty and unjust sentencing need to be abolished. Join a panel of exonerated prisoners and activists as we discuss the links between the historical practice of lynching, racism, and the criminal justice today. Speakers include Mark Clemens, sentenced to life without parole at age 16, based on a confession tortured out of him by Chicago police, released last year. Marvin Reeves, exonerated Illinois prisoner. Marlene Martin, national director of the campaign to end the death penalty. And Brian Dolner, Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice. The local tour stop is sponsored by the International Socialist Organization and Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice. For more information, contact iso.champaign@gmail.com or call area code 415-713-6260.
In this last excerpt from the interview with Deborah Thomas, she says more about the consent she signed giving police permission to search her home. Here again, she expresses concern with the second interview and the conditions in which police left her home. She also speaks to being questioned about Kewan being in a gang and responds to official claims that she changed her story. One of the most poignant aspects of her interview is the certainty with which Deborah Thomas explains that Kewan would have never done anything destructive to her home.
First, they asked me before they gave me a piece of paper, was it okay if they searched my home to make sure anyone was in there? I said, okay. Then if I'm mistaken, they said, we're going to give you this piece of paper to sign.
Did they move on or did they?
Yeah.
And then they went on to the rest of the question.
Yeah.
The second time
they asked me again on the thing when they were just reading off, and they said, and you did give us consent to search your home. I said yes.
Do you remember if they said anything else to you that sounded different than they said the first time about the consent?
Yeah, because the first time when I asked them consent to why you want to search my home, they said to make sure no one else was in there. So, of course, they lead me to believe that the house had been broken into, so this is what I'm thinking. It was already a burglary. And I'm thinking in my head automatically, though, it's grown people, because that's what they told me. They told me it was no kids. They said it was two grown men. So, of course, you know, I mean, the first thing went up. The first one, when they said, will you consent us to search your home to make sure no one else is in there? Yeah, I said yes. So as we go on down the list, I remember them saying again, and you did give us permission to search your home. Yes.
What was your frame of mind the second time?
I was mad then.
The second time?
I was mad because I had to do it again. And I knew they was lying because I felt, come on now. I seen y'all flick this thing on. Y'all told me I was going to be on audio and video.
So,
and they're trying to say the first one didn't take. The audio wasn't on, they said.
Okay, now, when they got to that consent paper, were you looking at something when they said it, or were they sort of just talking to you?
Second time I remember saying, and you did give us consent to search your home. That's what I remember. They said they were going to come in my home to make sure no one else was in here. That was it. They pulled everything out, though. We all know that.
And if they had said that they wanted permission to go through your things,
no.
Then both that.
Because that was the first thing I said. I said, you guys ain't going to be digging through drawers and nothing looking like that.
In the first interview?
Yep, and they said no. But they tore it up what it was.
You were giving them permission to do that. You were giving them permission just to come in.
They were supposed to look around, make sure nobody else was in.
So you did. No one told you that they battle rammed your door?
I didn't know that till Saturday, when he was standing there with me, so the lady on the ice house told me. She said, that's the first thing she said. I'm going to tell you right now, they battle rammed your door. That's what she told me. I said, what? What you mean? Because I was led the impression that the house was already broken into. See what I'm saying? That was what they gave me the impression the house was already broken into. And that's what I thought when I told them, yeah, that you can search it.
Is that why you never thought about offering them a key and they never
asked
you? Yeah,
exactly. Because I thought it had already been broken into.
Did you think about why aren't they asking you for keys?
No, because they had led me to the fact to believe that the house was broken into. That's why they shot the person. But then they were still asking me more about Kiwan. Was he in a gang?
Well, wait, but let me just back up. When did you see the guy when you...
Oh, I didn't talk to him until like Sunday.
The black state trooper.
Yeah.
Because he was out here. So when was his formal interview that he wanted to talk to you?
I can't remember the first day.
What do you remember what you talked about? And did he record it?
If I'm mistaken, the first time he recorded, and I think it was just me and him. The first time, the second time he came back, it was me, him, and another cop. We were sitting right here in front of the house next door, inside the car.
Did he come here to tape you?
I sat in his car. I wasn't letting him in because it was so many people.
How do you know he was taping you in his car?
They showed me a little thing like that.
Oh, just a little recorder.
Mm-hmm.
And what did he say to you?
They asked me, was it okay if he bought video, but recorded me.
What was he asking you?
My only questions about Kiwan. Was he, what kind of kid he was? And was he welcome at my house? And how long had I known him? And
did you feel like it was the same questions you had already been asked?
No, some of them wasn't. I don't know, when they started getting to his gang stuff, was he in a gang? And I remember saying, what, N-E-G? I'm like, that's not a gang. That's all the little neighborhood kids. Ain't no gang. That's just a little what they call, It's not a gang, though. I remember him asking me that.
Who's the one that came up with what we read in the newspaper and other places about you changing your story? How did that?
I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what part of the story did I change. You talking about the question, about the champagne lesson, was anyone supposed to be at your house? That's the question only one I can think of. And that's when that came up, actually, to me, what kind of sparked my memory when we went to court with Jay Sean the very first time. And they said, they still trying to say he got in trouble for burglary because they said you changed your story. And I'm like, well, how? That's when Jay Sean first went to court. And they said, you saying that wasn't nobody supposed to be at your house? I said, but that's what I meant. During that time of day, all kids are supposed to be at school. So that's what I was meaning by, wasn't nobody supposed to be at my house? Not during that time of day.
Okay, when you walked in and you saw your house all torn up, who did you think tore up your house?
The police.
They were saying it was an attempted burglary. Why didn't you ever think it was somebody in here rubbing you through your stuff?
Because I know Kiwan ain't going to do that. Kiwan ain't never done that. He would never. As soon as I seen my house, I knew the police had to do it because I gave them the consent to search. But that was, they told me a walk through.
Buenas. Flaco. Llámame Flaco. Pero mi primer nombre es Yacine Dante, el apellido del Bey. Oiga, mis ojos son testigos, la hermosa y el peligro distinto. Claro que sí, la verdad, la calle, el pueblo, las fincas y centros, ciudad, calidad, lo mejor, mal y más, guerra y vida, amor y cambia, comida, la guarda, pistola, oración para ellos, damas y caballeros, familia, crianza, la luz en la distancia, querido Dios, viene más cercana mi vista, mi casa, mis sueños, mi alma. Quiero saberlo sin ti, tu abrazo y tu contacto, muéstrame algo, claro. Amén, claro, claro, claro que sí. No hay nada más, no hay nada más, final no hay nada más. Claro, claro, claro que sí. No hay nada más, y no hay nada más, final no hay nada más. Claro, claro, claro que sí.
This is WFT 90.1 FM Community Radio.
This is Brian Doliner, independent journalist with the Public Eye newspaper and the Independent Media Center. We're here today with Carrie Pimblot of the GEO Solidarity Committee and also a member of CU Citizens for Peace and Justice. We're here today to talk about the Kiwan Carrington case, the 15-year-old African-American youth who was shot and killed by Champaign police on October 9th. After Kiwan was killed, there were rallies, vigils, several large public events, a massive outcry. This story was in the newspapers just about every day, and we immediately got on the case, got calls about it. We held a press conference with the family at the Independent Media Center. They expressed their deep concerns, their many questions that they still had about that day, October 9th, when Kiwan and his best friend, Jayshon, were trying to get into a house where Kiwan had been staying, and a neighbor called a non-emergency phone number to the police station to have them come check it out. He expressed he wasn't deeply concerned, but did call the Champaign Police Station, its non-emergency number, for them to come look into it. The two police first on the scene was Chief R.T. Finney and Officer Daniel Norbitz. They had their guns drawn. They were telling the youth to get down on the ground. The ground was muddy, wet, and whatever happened behind that house, a gun went off and killed Kiwan Carrington. Since then, the state's attorney, Julia Reitz, has released her determination. On December 8th, she came out saying that this was an accidental killing. She ruled out first-degree murder or involuntary manslaughter charges. The local newspapers had already been claiming that this was an accidental shooting, and so many of us in the community were not surprised that was an accident, supposedly. And since then, we've been able to get our hands on the investigation by the state police, a 13-page report released by Julia Reitz. Carrie Pimblot's a PhD student in the history department and a member of the GEO, the Graduate Employees Organization, and also a member of CU Citizens for Peace and Justice. She's been poring over this report released by the state's attorney and the investigation done by the Illinois State Police. In the January edition of the Public Eye newspaper, she wrote an article about the Kiwan killing. Carrie, can you tell us something of what you found looking through the report?
Well, prior to actually looking at the report itself, we started to look at the investigation that was performed by the Illinois State Police to ask whether we should take seriously the state's attorney's findings in the case or whether the evidence in the case had been contaminated in some way by an investigation that lacked independence or accountability. And actually, that is what we found as a group after we had looked into how the investigation was performed. And many of these concerns had been raised earlier by CU Citizens for Peace and Justice, but actually our examination of the case itself too revealed that there were several causes for concern with the investigation that produced the evidence upon which the state's attorney Julia Reitz made her decision. And so a couple of those concerns that we had with the investigation consisted of, for example, officers that had been central to the actual case itself, so Chief R.T. Finney and Officer Daniel Norbitz, who were directly involved with the shooting, were permitted to stay on duty during the course of the investigation. And in Chief R.T. Finney's case, I mean, we're talking about an individual that has a lot of superiority within the police department, has oversees other officers, supervises other officers, and whether or not was, overseeing the investigation itself, which he wasn't, did play a role still in the police department that would have impacted people's investigation, at least raises concerns of that.
So what does this mean? R.T. Finney was around? Was he at his desk? Was he in the police station at this time while the investigation was pending?
That's correct. He wasn't suspended. And so that is a serious cause for concern.
So he is able to have direct contact and conversation with police in the police station.
Despite the fact that he was a primary witness in the case and was interviewed as part of the investigation. So, yes, that's a serious concern.
And so the police who were, and there was over a dozen police interviewed, in effect, their boss was still in the office.
That's correct.
And so anything that they might have said could have immediately threatened their job, for example.
That is exactly the case.
And also the officer who actually killed Kiwan, Officer Norbitz, was put on paid leave, and he was gone for a couple weeks, but was back to his desk even before this investigation was concluded.
That is correct, too. And so we see in this case it would have been more intelligent for them to remove the officers entirely from the force so that they could have had an independent investigation, but they chose not to do that, which really causes concerns for members of the community looking at this evidence and trying to take seriously the conclusions the state's attorney's drawn. But that's just one of the factors. I mean, there is a whole range of other factors that also contaminate the evidence in the case. And so, for example, they did, and Chief Finney is not obligated to actually hand this case outside of his own department, despite the fact that officers were involved. The use of force policy and other departmental policies for the Champaign Police Department do not demand that the officers hand it outside of the Champaign Police Department. So Chief Finney did, but, I mean, that does not mean that this investigation was in any way independent, because the police departments that were responsible for constituting the multi-jurisdictional investigative team that did the investigation were actually from peer kind of neighboring towns, police departments that knew many of the officers involved in the case very well, had trained with the officers at the Police Training Institute, had taken training courses with them elsewhere, maybe socialized together, live in similar towns, because since then we have identified that the vast majority of Champaign police officers do not actually reside in Champaign. They live in small communities with very small minority populations outside of Champaign-Urbana. So these people have very close connections, train on the same firing ranges as Champaign police. And it was those officers, along with state police from Zone 5, that were responsible for performing the investigation. Whether we're supposed to take seriously that these officers truly are capable of performing an independent investigation, highly questionable.
And so what other ways is this investigation tainted in your mind?
Well, looking at some of the transcripts of the interviews themselves, we can see that this isn't just a hypothetical argument we're making here that officers knew each other from the investigative team and from Champaign Police Department. You can see that in the transcripts of the interviews that were performed. And so especially the interview with Officer Norbitz and the interview with Officer Russell Burke from Champaign Police Department to another officer that was on the scene in the aftermath of the shooting. Those interviews, the techniques that were used by the officers from the investigating team were very dubious. There were incidents in which the investigating officer asked Officer Russell Burke to relax, essentially, acknowledge that we're both police officers. We're not interrogating you. We don't mean this to be a hostile environment. We just want to hear your report. It's like writing a written statement, basically trying to put the officer at ease in his testimony, and not really actually performing any investigative role. I mean, very bizarre in many of these interviews, really trying to clarify what happened with the officers, but give them every opportunity through the use of leading questions, especially in Officer Norbitz's interview, to try and allow Officer Norbitz to make a case for himself, not asking investigative questions that would actually clarify what happened.
And while most all the other officers were interviewed on October 9th, immediately after the shooting, Norbitz was not interviewed until 4 days later. Can you explain that?
And that is the part I think that is the most problematic in terms of the evidence. You have two people that have actually been interviewed that saw what happened with the actual shooting. That's Chief Finney and Officer Norbis. Obviously, Kiwan's best friend has not testified for other reasons that we should talk about. But Officer Norbis, one of two people that actually saw what happened here, that's actually spoken with police about it, was given a four-day delay before he gave his interview with officers of the multi-jurisdictional investigative team. This is unprecedented. This does not happen with any of the other interviewed people in the case. For example, Kiwan's best friend, despite having endured a very traumatic incident and being a juvenile, is taken immediately to the police station and asked to give testimony straight after the incident. Chief Finney, the same thing happens. Every other officer that is on the scene at the time or in the immediate aftermath of the shooting is interviewed straight away. However, what happens with Officer Norbitz is that legal counsel, Labour counsel Tom Sonneborn, is present at the police station and asks Troy Daniel, this is the deputy chief, allow Officer Norbitz a four-day delay as a result of memory loss problems that he is facing because of the traumatic incident that he's faced. Obviously, this may have been experienced by Kiwan's best friend too, but that's never considered and no four-day delay is given to him. But the officers collectively from the Illinois State Police investigation and the Champaign Police Department collectively decide that psychologically it would be better for Officer Norbitz to take that time off.
And did he have any better recollection 4 days later?
Actually, no. And this is what's incredible. Very sketchy recollection of things that are central to the case. For example, how Officer Norbitz came to have his finger inside the trigger guard and his gun out and unholstered in the middle of trying to take a juvenile into custody. All of those kind of things are very hazy. But he has very clear recollection 4 days later about Kiwan apparently putting his hands inside of his jacket, a comment that Chief Finney had also made in his interview 4 days prior. Now, we don't know if conversations, it would have been entirely illegal for conversations to have taken place between a superior officer and Officer Norbitz in that 4 days, but we do not know that that wasn't the case. And the 4 days does allow for a lot of concern to be raised about the nature of the interview that is then performed with Officer Norbitz, and especially in terms of what kind of legal counsel he would have obtained in the 4 days to get a sense of what charges might be filed against him, what kind of evidence would be incriminating if he made certain statements and not others, and then also he would have known within 4 days that Kiwan's best friend was not actually going to be able to test because he was going to be facing criminal charges that would basically result in him incriminating himself if he gave any statement about what happened to Kiwan. And so in that sense, by 4 days later, Officer Norbitz has a very good sense of what kind of legal ramifications he might be facing, what kind of information he should probably refer to in the interview, what he shouldn't refer to in the interview, and what other information may come out from Jayshon in this case that might actually counteract his own statements. For me, that raises so many concerns that an independent investigation has to be performed.
And while the state's attorney, Julia Reitz, committed what was really a character assassination on several of the African-American witnesses, she claimed that the officers' testimonies were all similar, and she found them all credible. But can you point out some of the inconsistencies in the police own statements?
So this is the case, and now this is saying, let's say we accept the evidence in this case, that it wasn't tampered with, it wasn't produced by faulty kind of interviewing practices or by a team that lacked independence. So we look at the evidence itself, and there's multiple inaccuracies or inconsistencies between different officers' testimonies that, you know, really are not focused on in the state's attorney's findings and in her report. As you said, she really focuses on the inconsistencies that exist between civilian eyewitnesses and witnesses' reports. And so really the vast majority of the kind of inconsistencies that exist between Chief Finney and Officer Norbitz in their testimonies of what occurs behind the back of the house. They're the only two other people that will have seen this other than Kiwan's best friend. And so it's critical that those testimonies line up very closely, because otherwise there is cause for concern about whether what Officer Norbitz claims he did actually occurred, right? So, no, in this sense, Chief Finney describes, for example, Kiwan's body being located very close to Jayshon's body on the ground when they're trying to wrestle the two individuals to the ground. Officer Norbitz doesn't suggest that, suggests that the bodies are located slightly further apart. There is concerns about where they're positioned, how and when the gun goes off. And then I think the critical one for me is in the aftermath of the actual shot, Officer Stephen Reynolds' testimony, which the state's attorney doesn't really go into a lot of the detail in her own report, raises some serious concerns about actually Officer Norbert's his kind of immediate response after the shooting. So, for example, Officer Norbert in his testimony says that, you know, he fires the weapon. He doesn't know how that happens. Key One's then down on the ground, and then the testimony kind of ends at that point. Stephen Reynolds argues that when he comes around the back of the house, as soon as he's heard the shot, he sees Officer Norbert looking around the scene, trying to identify what's happened. He asks Jayshon if he's okay, and then he asks Key One if he's okay, and Key One doesn't respond, almost as though Officer Norbert doesn't know who he has shot in that moment. For me, extremely reckless behaviour indicates that maybe the gun could have been waving anywhere and risking anybody's life at that point. Officer Norbert doesn't talk about that in his own testimony. Seems to indicate that, you know, he was quite clear what had happened afterwards. And so that raises some serious concerns about what the state of mind of the officer was in the moment. And this is information that Officer Stephen Reynolds offered after his first testimony with police. He comes back and makes further statements with police about this because he's concerned about it. That's not been raised in the case.
Well, in the police account, they say that when they approached the scene, that they had their guns drawn, that police were yelling out, get on the ground. But in Chief Finney's statement, he acknowledges that, and he calls them himself, these bad guys that they were after. But he also acknowledges that they were kids. And so did they have, there's been a lot of talk about this use of force policy in the Champaign Police Department. Did they have, in your mind, proper reason to approach those two kids with guns drawn?
Well, a lot of this rests upon, as well, this testimony that Officer Norbert has given that's confirmed Chief Finney's statements that Key One's hands were going in and out of the pockets. This piece for me is the most problematic evidence in the case because it's the distinct recollection that Officer Norbert has, despite having very sketchy recollection on almost everything else. And what this suggests is that officers were kind of justified in the belief, therefore, that their weapon may have been present on one of the two boys, and that they therefore were justified in having their weapons out during engaging in this kind of like attempt to take the children into custody. Now, of course, Champaign Police Department's use of force policy for juveniles, which is essentially not even a use of force policy because they do not advocate the use of force really in this policy for taking juveniles into custody. And this is the actual language from the juvenile kind of use of force policy. Police officers are encouraged to use the least coercive enforcement action of the reasonable available alternatives in properly executing their law enforcement responsibilities. And additionally, in the next section of the report, it says that only reasonable and necessary force may be used to protect the officer and or take custody of the minor. So actually, in approaching juveniles, there is a different method that's encouraged. This is true also in Illinois State training for law enforcement, that different approaches are required, and that in this case, the officers shouldn't have been approaching the youth with the weapons drawn unless they probably really feared that a deadly use of force was possible. Now, the way they're justifying that from their testimony is this argument that the hands of Keywon Carrington were going in and out of his pockets. This is a huge discrepancy then in their actual interviews because neither Officer Norbert or Chief Finney alleges that they actually checked his pockets after they shot him. For me, this suggests then that they've actually made up this argument afterwards to justify an accidental, is what they're calling, very suspicious shooting, because they shouldn't have had their weapons drawn in the first place. And so that is a serious cause for concern. They compromise their own departmental policy, the training that they've had in terms of, at most, we're saying that Key One was passively resisting arrest. In that case, the only justifiable response, according to Illinois training laws, is that they're supposed to be using kind of control holds. They're supposed to be trying to use slight physical force to take the juvenile into custody, not approaching with weapons drawn, engaging in a physical struggle with weapons drawn. Extremely irresponsible, reckless behavior.
How could it be ruled accidental that a gun would just fire, as if the gun shot itself and no one pulled the trigger?
And that's actually obviously not possible. The only way that could happen would be, for example, if you had a gun that had an external safety that was off and then you drop the gun or it discharges. That's not what happened in this case, and nobody's alleging that that happened in this case. In fact, the gun that Officer Norbitz was using, which is a Glock 45, we did some research into the weapon, and it has internal safeties, which mean that if you drop that weapon during a struggle, it cannot discharge involuntarily. And so, let's be very clear, to fire that weapon, you have to pull the trigger. Now, it has a very light trigger, and this is true, which means that officers are trained to be very careful with their weapons. And Officer Norbitz, in his own interview with investigators directly after the shooting 4 days later, confirms that he had been trained to hold the gun with his finger index down the barrel, not to keep his finger inside the trigger guard. That would have been a reckless act, right? So we assume, therefore, if the gun has internal safeties and the gun goes off, then he has to have his finger inside the trigger guard. Therefore, he recklessly disregarded his own training and approached an unarmed juvenile with his finger inside the trigger guard. That's reckless behavior. And so, no, the gun cannot just go off by itself. It's a very carefully constructed testimony by Officer Norbitz in his interview with officers that he is claiming he can't remember how this even happened. Because for it to happen, he had to have his finger inside the trigger guard. And if you look at an image of a Glock, it's very clear that there is no way he could have slipped and his finger fallen inside the trigger guard and pulled the trigger. It's just not possible. He had to have been engaging in a physical struggle with Kiwan, who was passively resisting, with his hand on his gun with his finger inside the trigger guard. And I think on most counts, people would consider that to be excessive in the treatment of a juvenile, very heavy-handed, irresponsible, and I would argue reckless, which would warrant criminal charges being filed.
So let's talk about the criminal charges that could have been brought against Champaign Police Officer Daniel Norbitz. The state's attorney considered a first-degree murder charge, which she found invalid, but considered also involuntary manslaughter, but thought that that could not be brought before a jury and the officer found guilty. Can you talk about the distinction between those two and her determination?
And I should be clear that I'm not a lawyer. And sometimes I think community members are disempowered by the fact that we don't have access to certain forms of knowledge that people like the state's attorney do in making their cases. But I don't think this should stop us, because I think looking at the Illinois statutes on these different charges of first-degree murder versus involuntary manslaughter, some common sense things just come out of it. So with the first-degree murder charge, the way that that is referred to in the statute requires that an individual have to have intent to kill the person in question, to intend to pull the trigger. And since Officer Norbitz claims that he didn't have that intent, it was accidental, according to him. And because Chief Finney's testimony, the only other eyewitness that's spoken out, doesn't contradict that, the state's attorney correctly says, based on that evidence, that there isn't any grounds for filing a charge of first-degree murder. Now, she doesn't have any evidence to contradict that. She would if she wasn't simultaneously prosecuting the only other eyewitness in the case who would incriminate himself in his own case if he did come out and speak on this issue. So Jayshon may know that something else happened, especially according to Chief Finney's testimony, that they were very close to each other when the shooting occurred, him and Kiwan, may have other testimony. But we don't know because the state's attorney has closed the door on that, which for me is a serious problem.
And so, Carrie, what are the requirements for a charge of involuntary manslaughter?
In this case, the state's attorney also considered involuntary manslaughter as a charge, and decided eventually that that charge was not warranted either, right? But what she's looking at when she decides whether involuntary manslaughter occurred is whether the individual that was involved in the death of Kiwan Carrington acted recklessly. And the term recklessly, its legal definition, is having a conscious disregard of a substantial and unjustifiable risk that is a gross deviation from the standard of care which a reasonable person would exercise in the same situation. So what's interesting about this is the way the state's attorney decides to use that language. She takes essentially the term conscious disregard from that, saying that Officer Norbitz could not have consciously disregarded a risk because he didn't consciously pull the trigger. That's what she's arguing. That he had no intent to fire the trigger, to pull the trigger. It was an accident. And therefore, he didn't consciously disregard an unjustifiable risk, which therefore means he was not reckless. And it may sound initially confusing, but in reality, is it true that he didn't act recklessly, is what I'm asking. And so we went through and we looked at the evidence in the case, the evidence that she looked at too, to see if we drew the same conclusion, and we did not. Everything that Officer Norbitz did, whether it was intended to or not, was a conscious disregard of an unjustifiable and substantial risk. You're going to engage in that kind of behaviour. You are risking people's lives. And what Officer Reynolds' testimony shows in the immediate aftermath of the shooting is that Officer Norbitz was so reckless, he could have actually shot anybody that was in that scene in the backyard. He could have shot Chief Finney by accident. He could have shot Kiwan or Jayshon, and he would have never known. In fact, he did not know until immediately afterwards. If that's not recklessness, common sense-wise, then what is the state's attorney's rationale here? I mean, it seems as though really she wants the officers to not face a court case on this. And so for me, I think that is just one example of which recklessness was used. We could also say that Chief Finney was reckless in his approach to the scene, and I do believe he was. Chief Finney is a superior officer to Officer Norbitz. In his own testimony with police, Officer Norbitz alleged that Chief Finney's actions were central to his decision to approach the scene with his weapon drawn and to engage in a physical conflict with a juvenile with his weapon drawn, because Chief Finney came into the scene and immediately shouted at two unarmed teenagers, "Get down or I will shoot you." He did not identify himself properly as police. We could say that was reckless. He's admitted he did not identify himself properly as a police officer, wasn't wearing police uniform, was wearing a chief shirt and jeans. So we don't know if they knew who he was even. Tells them he's going to shoot them despite the fact they're unarmed and they are juveniles, which contradicts all of the training that he's been given to, and therefore creates a situation in which other officers who are underneath his leadership escalate their fears, approach the situation in the most heavy-handed case possible, resulting in one juvenile's death at the end of the case. I mean, it's ridiculous that this could not have gone to court, at least. The actual evidence itself, I mean, it suggests that essentially charges should have been brought against either one or both of the officers for recklessness. And I think the community demands that that is the case, that we get to have a proper trial to see the evidence and to see officers justify what they did, because otherwise other people will lose their lives.
The other individual in this case who still remains tied up in the criminal justice system was the other 15-year-old there, Jayshon, who was with Kiwan, watched his best friend be killed by police. Jayshon is still caught up in the system. What's his status in the courts?
So he is the only person facing any criminal charges in relation to this case. And he's facing obstructing and resisting a peace officer. And so his case is still in the court system. And the state's attorney has refused, despite demands by the community, to drop the charges.
Indeed, we had a petition circulating that we took to the last court hearing. We had over 400 signatures gathered and presented them to the state's attorney. She said that it had no influence over how she prosecuted the case. We're still collecting signatures for the next court date. You can find the petition to drop the charges on Jayshon if you simply Google petition drop charges Jayshon. It's Jeshaun. His next court date is on February 17th at 2:45 in courtroom C at the Champaign County Courthouse in downtown Urbana. Please come down to the courthouse. Join us out for this hearing on Tuesday, February 17th.
Fight on, sisters, fight on, fight on and free your fellow man.
We want to thank our listeners for being with us today on Liberacion. Many thanks to Deborah Thomas and the work of CU Citizens for Peace and Justice. A special thanks to Carrie Pimblot for all her hard work, and of course Brian Dollinger for their contributions to this segment of Liberacion.
Back in shackles, you see my brothers fight on.
us fight on. Fight on and free this land. Fight on, sisters, fight on. Fight on and free your fellow men. Brothers are scorned in exile for such, such a long while. Fascism too vile, brothers, fight on. I say fight on, brothers, fight on. Fight on and free this land. I say fight on, sisters, fight on. Fight on and free your fellow man. We need majority rule. Simit and Vasta is too cool.
This program has been produced by the Liberación Radio Collective, a community grassroots effort that seeks to embrace a vision of freedom, solidarity, and social change. We hope you'll join us in the struggle.
Fight on, fight on.